can communicate that and everybody gets on the same page, like, oh, okay, that's where we're going. And that's our vision. Well, how can we apply that to the church? How can we apply that to our lives as Christians? How can we apply that to even our congregation here? What's a vision that we can have for where we're going? Well, if that's a question that we're considering, where would we expect to find the answer? If we've got a vision, it's going to be found in the Word of God, right? That's where we take our marching orders. That's where we get our direction from. Now, when you look at the Bible and you think about visions in the Bible, you probably think of a different kind of usage of the word, right? People in the Bible receive visions, and that would usually mean some kind of supernatural communication from God. They would be shown a vision of something. That's not really the way we're using the word. What we're saying, the way we're using the word in this lesson is, what is our goal? Where are we trying to get to? How would we know if we're going in the right direction? How do we know if we are making progress? How do we know we're moving in the right way? And so that's kind of the question. And so could we find things in the New Testament that we could equate to a vision statement for a local church that says, here's where you should be moving. Here's what you should be aiming for. Here's the goals that you should measure yourself against. And that's an interesting thing to consider. That's something I've been challenged with lately. So I've been giving it a lot of thought. And I think that we can find such visions in the New Testament. And they come in the form of prayers that Paul offers on behalf of these churches. And he writes to them, and in his letters to them, he often includes a prayer for them. And he says, here's what I'm praying for you. And I want to share with you three of those this morning. And I think you'll agree as we look at them, they make for a really good vision as he's saying to them, here's what I pray to God every day, and here's what I pray for you. And then he lists some things. And as we look at those, it really makes a neat picture. It's like Paul is painting a picture for them of what he envisions for them and their future. It's obviously a goal that they need to move toward, that they need to try to, be moving in that direction. And so that's what I want to share with you today. Three such prayers of Paul and how we can use them to think of them like a vision. So we're going to start with the letter to the Philippians, the church in Philippi. Let's first just note that Paul did a lot of praying. I think that'll come through loud and clear in this lesson. Look at verses 3 through 5 of Philippians 1. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. You'll notice that. You've probably noticed it before. It'll come through loud and clear this morning that Paul is constantly praying for these churches. And so I think let's take that as a challenge right off the bat. For me, for you, how often do I pray in my regular prayers for the church? For churches in another place? For our church. That was an important part of Paul's prayer life. And, you know, if we think about what's your typical prayers? You think through in your mind what you pray in the morning, what you pray at night. And we probably pray for food. We probably pray, that's getting hard to say. We probably pray for our families and things like that. We're instructed in other places to pray for our leaders of our nation and pray for those in power. And so we have some things, but let's also, if it's not part of your regular prayer, let me challenge you and challenge myself to pray for our congregation, because that's a good thing. And we have a good apostolic example here. If he says, I'm always praying for you. Now let's consider what he prayed for them. The statement that we're looking for here is in verses 9 through 11. It is my prayer that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent, and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God. Now that works as a vision statement, wouldn't you agree? If you're looking for like a picture of what success looks like, what a congregation is supposed to be, what a church should be, I think this paints a great picture. Let's just break it down one phrase at a time as we look at that. First of all, he says, click on the screen that's got the... Let me come back. Maybe can you hit the end button? Is it locked up? It was working and then it quit. Bear with me just a moment. Technical difficulties. Yeah, that's fine. No problem. Let's try clicking over here. All right. Now, let me move this mouse a little bit. Okay. First thing he says is that your love would abound more and more. Now, as we consider that, I would ask you to think about yourself. Do you feel like that you have love for other people? Do you feel like you have love for your neighbor? Do you feel like you have love for your brothers and sisters in this room? I hope so. Is that an important part of being a Christian? Yep. So let's say that you feel like, I think I'm loving. You know what I think Paul would say to you? Love more. Hold your place there and turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. You know, the Thessalonians were kind of a poster child for love. In fact, Paul says, you know, that they're basically they're setting the example of what it looks like to love. They're doing excellent at that. If we want to see some people who are loving, we could look at this example of the Thessalonian church. In 1 Thessalonians 4, beginning of verse 9, he said, concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you. For you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. It's almost like you don't even, he's basically saying, I can't teach you anything about love. You've learned it straight from the source. So you don't need me to write to you and tell you something about loving people because you learned it straight from God. And yet, look what he says in the next verse. That is indeed what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, to do this more and more. He's basically saying, you're setting the bar for love, but you know what? I want to challenge you to even love more. You're doing so good that I can't write to you anything, but I'm going to write to you anyway. And what I'm going to say to you is, I'm going to urge you, you're doing great, do it even better. Have you ever had a review like that? It feels good, right? When the boss says, you know what? You're doing a great job, but you know I'm going to challenge you for next year? I want to see you do even better, right? If you're the coach, right? And you see this all the time with certain really highly successful coaches that win kind of constantly. But they're always pushing for, hey, that was good. But you know what? I believe we can do better. And that's how we grow, right? And Paul's saying here to them, you guys are doing a great job of loving, but I want you to love even more. And back in our passage in Philippians, the first thing he says is that your love would abound more and more. Secondly, he says, with all knowledge and discernment. With knowledge and discernment comes the ability to approve what is excellent, as he goes on to say. If you don't have knowledge and discernment, you can't approve what's excellent. To discern means to decide between. And so you need this knowledge and this wisdom and understanding so that you can know what is good and bad. You can approve what is excellent. And if you're short on knowledge, you're going to have trouble knowing what's good and bad and what we should or shouldn't do and what is right or wrong. He's going to emphasize this in the next prayer, so I'm going to say more about it as we come to that in the next one. The next thing he says, that you would be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. Hold your place there and turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Pure and blameless for the day of Christ. In Ephesians 5, the church is compared to the bride of Christ. Let's start in verse 25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Picture in your mind the wedding day, the excitement that builds up to that, and that moment when the groom is not supposed to see the bride, of course, before. That's all the whole thing, right? He's not supposed to see her. And then he comes in, and it's a real joy being a preacher to get to stand up there in the front with the groom. And you're waiting, and then the door opens, and they come around the corner, and there she is. And she's supposed to be radiant, right? And perfect and beautiful, and every hair in the right place, and everything about the whole thing is supposed to be just, this is her moment, right? And it's just, it's a beautiful thing. And that whole ceremony is a type of the church in Christ is what Paul is saying. And so when Jesus, what he's looking for is in the end, when the day of Christ comes, his church appears and she is in splendor without spot or blemish. And I think that's exactly what Paul is saying here to the Philippians. His prayer for them is that they would be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. That when Jesus shows up, you'd be this radiant bride. That's an important part of our vision for the congregation. We can't be radiant, we can't be pure, we can't be holy if we're also caught up in sin, if we are defiled by worldliness and sinful attitudes and sinful actions, then we're not spotless and without blemish. So that's the goal. That's what we're shooting for. That's what we need to be aiming for. The next thing he says is, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ. Do you remember in Matthew 21, verse 19, do you remember that Jesus was walking along and he got hungry and he looked over and he saw a fig tree? Do you remember that story? And he went over to the fig tree and it said he found on it nothing but leaves. Does everybody remember that? He looked at it and he found nothing but leaves and he cursed it. And he said, may no fruit ever be born on you again. He was frustrated with that fruit tree, that fig tree, because it was nothing but leaves. What did the Lord design fig trees to do way back in the beginning? This same Lord who was standing there looking at it was part of creation. And what were fig trees designed to do? Make figs, right? And so what is the point of a fig tree that isn't making figs? It's just sort of taking up space. And that's the same thing Jesus talks about in John 15 with the, my Father's the vine dresser, I'm the vine, and any vine in me that bears fruit, he prunes so it'll bear more fruit. Any vine in me that does not bear fruit, he cuts it off and they're thrown aside and they wither up and dry and they're ready to be thrown in the fire. The point is, it's not just enough to be alive. We need to be bearing fruit. And so Paul's prayer for the Philippians is that you would be filled with the fruit, that when the Lord comes to inspect you and he lifts up the branch, you're just overflowing, burdened down. Papa used to have these peach trees that the branches would break. They would have so many, so he had to support them. He would put boards under them in places. Probably need to prune them better, I don't know. But he would like support them because this tree was just kind of, I remember that when I was a kid, it was just loaded down with fruit. And that's what the Lord is looking for. That's what Paul's praying for them, that you would be filled with the fruit of righteousness. That this knowledge and discernment doesn't just go into our heads and stop there, but that it actually produces this fruit in our lives. And that's, I think, a beautiful picture of a healthy church. Would you agree that that is a fantastic vision for the church at Philippi as Paul writes to them his prayer for them? Let's look at another example. Let's look at what he writes to the Christians in Colossae, in Colossians chapter 1. Another prayer, another vision of what a church is supposed to be. This one begins in verse 9. And so, from the day we heard, we have not ceased to pray for you. See, Paul's praying for them all the time. Not ceased to pray for you. What's he praying? Asking that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work, increasing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might for all endurance and patience with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. There's a lot of stuff here, and you could probably see that we could pick any one of these and really dive into it and spend a lot of time thinking about it. And in fact, I'm just going to tease this a little bit at the moment, but our Wednesday night series for next year will be based on this passage down through verse 23. Will be the theme, and it's going to be a little different from previous years. We're excited to tell you about it, but you'll need to be here for the congregational meeting first Sunday in October, and we'll tell you about that coming up. So that's good things coming, exciting things in the works. And this will be the theme passage. And so they're basically the topics for that series will come from this passage. You could probably just scan over those verses we just read and see a lot of topics right there that we could take and explore. But just for today, we're just kind of hitting the high points and looking at it for the picture that it's painting. So first of all, he says, filled with the knowledge of his will. I meant to point this out on the last one. In the last one, he said, filled with, you remember? Filled with the fruit of righteousness. This one he says, filled with the knowledge of his will. In each of these three prayers, there's a different phrase that says filled with. So at the very end, I'm going to remind you of those filled with phrases as we kind of summarize this. So to the Colossians, he writes, my prayer to God for you, and I pray for you all the time, is that you would be filled with the knowledge of his will. Why is that important? Well, look what we gain from that in verse 9. Filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. Is wisdom important for us? Absolutely. Just look at how much of the Bible is focused on God giving his people the wisdom that they need to live like he wants them to live. And can you have wisdom with no knowledge? It's not going to work, right? And so we need not just a little knowledge. He doesn't want them to have half the knowledge they need. He doesn't want them to have most of the knowledge. He says, I want you to be filled with knowledge. So it's the idea that you know, I'm picturing like a container and you're just pouring it in. It goes all the way up. I had to replace the radiator on Jack's truck. I think, did I mention that already? I'm starting to have those kind of moments where I've told this story. But just the other day, his radiator broke. And, we talked about it in the high school class. This deja vu thing. I just said this. But in our high school class on Wednesday night, I told this story. But we had to put a new radiator on Jack's truck. And it was leaking, so we got a new one. And, of course, what do you do with a radiator? It's got to be filled up, right? So I'm pouring and pouring and pouring, looking and checking, pouring and pouring and checking, pouring and pouring and pouring until it fills up to the very, very top. That's the way it works. What if it's only got half the water in it that it needs? It ain't going to work right. But Paul is saying here, I want you to be filled with the knowledge of his will. And that's what we aim for. That's what we need. That's what we should be shooting for as a congregation. And what else is that going to produce? The next verse says, so as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. I think this is an interesting picture. Where does the knowledge go in? Imagine you're pouring that in your head, right? Your head's full of knowledge. But what if it just stops there? What if it's all just head knowledge? What if you got all these facts memorized? What if you can just rattle them off? What if I can say a verse and you can quote it to me? That's good, but what if it doesn't affect how you live? And I think what he's saying here is that knowledge needs to make it from your head down to your feet. It's got to affect the way you walk. You got to take that information and then it's got to direct your steps. It's got to guide your path. It's got to shape your life. Or else it really isn't helping you very much, is it? If it's just information. So we don't want church to be an academic pursuit where you study something, you take a test, you pass it, you get a ribbon, you get a certificate because you've got all this information. This is supposed to be a practicing thing that we take and go live it out and show it to people. And that's how we walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. I like this next phrase, fully pleasing to him. That tells me if the Lord came and he did an inspection and he had a scorecard, what would fully pleasing look like? Fives all the way down, right? If it's 5 out of 5, it's excellent. Imagine that. Imagine if the Lord comes and he's checking things out and he's saying, well, how was your worship? How was your service? How was your evangelism? How is your love for one another? How is your wisdom? How is your maturity? And he's got all these criteria that he's going to grade us on. Fully pleasing to the Lord would mean that he's completely happy with the way things are going, right? Now, probably, are we going to get fives down the board? I would think we might be told, well, here's some stuff you got to work on, right? And that's the whole point. A vision is what we're shooting for, where we're going. And the idea is we want to be fully pleasing to the Lord. So if I recognize in myself some area of weakness, and sometimes those are come to light in various ways, right? I recognize, ooh, I've got to do better about that. I need to grow in this way. There's something I can take and learn from and try to improve on. Well, good. That's an opportunity to grow. And that's a way to become more and more what the Lord would have us to be so we can be fully pleasing to him. And again, bearing fruit and increasing in knowledge, the same thing we saw in the prayer to the Colossians. And then he adds this phrase here that wasn't in the other letter, strengthen with all power according to his glorious might for all endurance and patience with joy. Paul prayed for the church there in Colossae that they would be strengthened with power through his might. And the reason for that strength is to give them patience and endurance. And I think that's anticipating hard days were going to come for them. Hard times are coming. And so he's praying for them that they would be strong so that they would have endurance and patience when the difficult days come. And those are coming, right? I don't know when. You don't know when, but you may be in the middle of some hard times at the moment. But those days come for all of us. And we need to be strengthened with power from his might so that we have endurance and patience with joy. Okay, let's look at one other example. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 3. This prayer is even more abstract than the others. It's more, it's less practical, less tangible, if I can use those kind of words. It's a little more challenging. I would suggest it may be a little more powerful in that way. It's something to really sit and ponder, okay? So let's look at what Paul says here in Ephesians chapter 3. It's a little bit of a different prayer, but it's still a prayer for them. Verse 14 beginning. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named. That, here's his prayer, according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being. Okay, that's similar to what we just read about that power thing. So that, verse 17, Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and the length and the height and the depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. That's powerful. So the first one said, filled with fruit of righteousness. Second one said, filled with all knowledge of his will. Third one says, filled with the fullness of God. Let me come back to that in a moment as we think about that. I want to compare that with a statement from Colossians 1. This was in, if we kept reading where we stopped with our prayer, he goes on to talk about the surpassing greatness of Jesus, the preeminence of Jesus. He says, he is the image of God, the firstborn of all creation. By him, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things. In him, all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. It comes as no surprise to any of us to read that all the fullness of God dwelt in Christ. We can't comprehend that, right? I've never met anybody that could explain it. It's beyond our ability to understand how somebody could be fully God and fully man. But we know that as a fact. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And so Jesus was God and man. He was in the beginning. He was before everything. Everything was created for him. He is the head of the body. He is preeminent. And in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. But here's the shocking thing. And I hope you're still open to Ephesians 3. Look at verse 19. To know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with the fullness, all the fullness of God. Wow. I don't understand it when it comes to Jesus, but I accept that Jesus was filled with the fullness of God. But now this is mind-blowing to me, that the Lord's plan for you and me is to be filled with the fullness of God. I don't think we would dare say that out loud if it wasn't written by an inspired writer. That we wouldn't dare attempt to attain that, to say that we could be filled with the fullness of God. So how is it possible that as Christians we can be filled with the fullness of God? Well, that's a huge question, but let's just look at what is said here in this prayer again in Ephesians 3. I want you to notice as we read through this prayer again how the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are all at work to accomplish this goal that we be filled with the fullness of God. Backing up again to verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father. Okay, so we're speaking of the Father first. From whom every family in heaven and earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, the Father, he may grant you. And then it goes on, to be strengthened to be these things. So first of all, it is the Father's will. The Father, for his glory, by his power, by his grace, by his plan, set this in motion, and this is his design and what he has in mind. If we're talking about what's the vision is painted by God. And here's what he's saying. The Father has this in mind. The Father does that. Now, that you may be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner beings. There's the Holy Spirit.
so that Christ, there's the Son, verse 17, may dwell in your hearts through faith.
So by faith in Jesus, He lives in me. You remember what Paul says? I've been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. We always start singing the song, right, Karen? Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. That's not the one I meant to start quoting, though. But he says, yes, it is. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. I got the song in my head and I almost forgot what I was saying. Paul says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me, right? How does Christ live in Paul? Through faith. Through faith, can Christ live in you? Yes, he better. That's what it means to be a Christian. So as Christians, as we are filled with the knowledge of his will, as we put that will into action, we start to walk by it, then guess who's really driving us? It's Jesus driving us because we've got his will in our heads. We're walking and following his path. We're strengthened by his spirit and we're doing what he wants us to do. And so we could say with Paul, it's no longer I who lives, but Christ lives in me. And guess what? If Christ lives in your heart by faith, as we continue reading, being rooted and grounded in love. I love that picture right there. When we plant, and we'll be doing this soon outside when we do the landscaping. But at our house, when you plant and you put a lot of thought into the, we didn't do that at first. We had to learn this the hard way. We just dug a hole, stuck a plant big enough for the thing, you know, and it died right away. If you get a root ball this big in a thing and you dig a hole exactly that size and you just set it in the ground and walk away, it is not going to live, okay? So you can learn that. You have to dig a bigger hole and make it nice and soft. And then we put like fertilizer in there or Miracle-Gro and stuff. We work that into the soil because we're trying to create like the perfect little place for this plant to thrive. But here Paul says that you may be rooted and grounded in love. And it makes me think of that. It's kind of like everything around. You're just given this perfect place to thrive, that you may be rooted and grounded in love, may have the strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. And we say, wow. And I think he anticipates that we're going to say wow, because look at what he says in verse 20 and 21. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus through all generations forever and ever. Amen. Is God's power limited by what you can imagine or understand? Thank God it's not. What if God would only do what you could understand? We'd be in trouble, right? But he can do far abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us. And so that's an awesome thing. But to stick with our theme today, what are we looking for here? Notice that the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, or that we may be filled with the fullness of God. As we summarize this, these three letters where Paul says, this is my prayer for you. And I think we could interpret that to say, this is his vision. This is what he's saying. This is what I hope you become. This is what I and praying to God that you will attain to. And so as we summarize those, he said that you would be filled with the knowledge of his will, that you would be filled with the fruit of righteousness, that you would be filled with all the fullness of God. Now, what's interesting about this vision and about what Paul prays for them is what he doesn't say. And did you notice that he didn't even say anything in any of there about their numbers? And I find that interesting because we don't know how big these churches were. There's nothing said about how big Colossae was or Church of Philippi or Ephesus. In fact, to my knowledge, the only membership numbers were ever given are the beginning in Acts when it said first there were 3,000, later there were 5,000 men. And after that, we don't know. So any of these churches, whether Antioch, Corinth, you name it, we don't know how big or small they were. But what's cool about this vision that's painted for them is that this is the same vision whether you have 5 people or 50 people or 5,000 people. It's the same vision. It's the same thing the Lord is looking for from us. Now, of course, we hope to grow in number too. But what Paul says he's praying for them is that they would be filled with the knowledge of his will, filled with the fruit of righteousness, and filled with all the fullness of God. And to me, that gives me a great image of what we should be growing toward and what we should be shooting for. And I hope that's been helpful and challenging to you this morning. Perhaps there's someone here among us this morning who has not given your life to the Lord, has not been baptized and put on Christ in baptism, if you've never done that and you know what to do and you're ready to do it today, or perhaps you have done those things and you've fallen away and would like to be restored, if there's some way that we can help you, please let us know.